So I wonder if the name Ruth Graham is familiar to anyone here. Ruth Graham was the wife of the famous evangelist, of course, Billy Graham. And she would often travel around with him as he went on his various speaking engagements all over the world. Now, at one point in the 1970s, Ruth and Billy Graham found themselves on a European speaking tour. And in specific, they were in the country of Germany. And the way that most of Billy's speaking engagements would work is at night at a big civic center, they would have what amounted to a big revival or big church service. And they were held at night so that people who worked all day could come and hear Billy speak. And come they did. They came by the thousands to hear Billy Graham's preaching, even though it was in a language that was foreign to them. But one afternoon before one of these church services, really in preparation for this service, Ruth Graham was invited to a luncheon with the wives of some of the most religiously conservative pastors in Germany. But, you know, Ruth Graham wasn't bothered. She was a fine, upstanding Christian woman, and she was just looking forward to get to know these other pastors' wives and have a little fellowship, get to meet them a little bit before that night service. So she went, and she didn't think anything about it. She dressed perfectly normally in a perfectly acceptable fashion for any church in the United States, save maybe an Amish church. Nothing conservative, nothing too revealing, nothing flashy, just proper churchwoman attire. But what she didn't know was that religiously conservative German Christians at the time had some very specific ideas about how women should dress and purport themselves in public. And specifically, they believed that married women should not wear makeup and should not dress in a manner that made them appear, quote-unquote, too worldly. So Ruth Graham showed up to this luncheon, and she sat down at a table across from another pastor's wife. And over the course of this luncheon, this woman sat across from her, just looking at Ruth Graham, taking in her on-point outfit, her tailored clothes, and her well-coiffed hair, her manicured nails, and worst of all, her mascara-laden eyelashes. I know, pretty scandalous. But over the course of the luncheon, this German woman found herself getting angrier and angrier and angrier. And so she was just filled up with all this emotion, and they didn't speak the same language, so she really couldn't express her outrage to Ruth Graham. So what this German woman did was she just started to cry, really, just weep. She started to bawl, and her tears fell into her mug of German beer and just kind of splashed in this mug of beer that she was drinking. Again, for her part, Ruth Graham did not speak German, and so had no idea what this woman's deal was. But after the luncheon, she commented to a friend about how inappropriate she thought it was that a pastor's wife was chugging on beer at a meeting in preparation for a church service that was just going to happen in just a couple hours. Thus we discover that is how churches have operated from the very beginning. Because when diverse people from diverse backgrounds, with diverse upbringings and diverse values, come together to form a faith community, without fail, they will have diverse opinions about the best and most appropriate way to live out that faith in their day-to-day lives. Some will think you shouldn't drink beer. Some will think you shouldn't wear mascara. They will have diverse opinions about the best and most appropriate way to live out their faith in their day-to-day lives. And that is exactly what was happening at the church in Rome to whom Paul is writing in today's passage. So the thing that they have, these diverse people in the Roman church are having diverse opinions about, is the appropriateness of eating meat. Specifically, meat that was deemed unclean by the purity laws found in the Old Testament. And the church at Rome, they were split into two very distinct camps. In one camp, you had the Jewish converts to Christianity, who believed that under no circumstances should you eat these meats that the New Old Testament deems as unclean. And then in this other camp, you have Gentile converts to Christianity, which is people who converted to Christianity from any other religion other than Judaism, who believed that you could eat whatever you want. They were perfectly okay with eating any sort of meat, clean or unclean. They didn't care what the Old Testament said. They thought you could eat it. So Paul is writing to them, and he's weighing in on this conflict. He wants to resolve it, bring it to an end, because he thinks it's causing a rift in the community. And Paul comes down decidedly in favor of one camp. Paul says in no uncertain terms that he believes that Christians can eat whatever kind of meat they want, clean or unclean, it does not matter. He even goes so far, Paul even goes so far as to label each of these groups. So the group that thought that they couldn't eat meat, he calls them weak. And the group that believed they could eat meat, he calls them strong. And those are some pretty loaded words, right? There's a value judgment happening there. So we need to be sure that we're remembering that by weak and strong, Paul is not commenting on their physical strength, nor is he commenting on their mental acuity, nor is he really commenting on the strength of their faith, per se. But what he's really commenting on is their ability to interpret the implications of their faith for how they should live their daily lives. So the strong group, he's saying, you got it right. He's saying, you understand that this faith thing, this Christian faith thing, it's all about grace. It's all about this idea that God's love is just a gift freely given to you. You didn't do anything to earn it. You didn't do anything to deserve it. It's entirely unmerited on your part. It is just a gift. And because this strong group recognized that it is just a gift and they didn't do anything to earn it, they also understood that there was nothing that they could do to lose it either. They understood that eating meat did not impact God's love for them in the least. But this group that Paul labels as weak, they still have a little bit of legalism kicking around in their heart. They have a little bit of what we call Phariseeism kicking around in their hearts, where they believe that by their right action, they can actually earn God's love. And so the reason they didn't want to eat meat is because they believed that if they did, they might lose God's love. So Paul says, no, weak folks, you don't really have it right. The strong group over here has it. It's all about grace, says Paul. It's all about God's freely given love. That's at the heart of this church community. That's what we're about. Now, as we've been working our way through Romans, we have noted that Paul was a bit of a stickler for doctrinal purity. He really cared that people were thinking and believing the right things. So what one might expect, or at least what I would expect when reading this passage, is that Paul would simply tell this weak group over here, with whom he doesn't agree, that he'd simply tell them to get in line. He'd simply tell them that they are wrong and that they should act more like the strong group, because the strong group are the people who are right. Paul actually did this with other apostles if he thought that they were incorrectly interpreting the gospel. But Paul throws us a bit of a curveball in this passage, because that's not how he approaches this situation. Instead, what Paul does is he talks to each group separately, and he tells each group to stop condemning and stop judging the other group. And he goes on to say something even a little more audacious. He says, in this particular situation, if anyone needs to change, it's actually the strong group. It is the group that has correctly interpreted the implications for their faith on their day-to-day living. Because, says Paul, it turns out that church communities are not about being right. And let me say that again to emphasize. Church communities are not about being right. Church communities are about lifting one another up in love, building one another up in the faith. And what Paul says to this strong group, this correct group, is that even though you are 100% correct, 100% right, if how you are living it is causing your brothers and sisters to stumble and to fall, it is incumbent on you, it is incumbent on you to change what you are doing. Ugh. That's a hard pill to swallow, isn't it? It feels a little un-American, doesn't it? Like, you are right, you are 100% correct. These people are wrong, they don't understand correctly, their faith isn't as strong as yours, and I have to change because of those fools? Like, that doesn't feel good, that doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? And it begs the question for us, I think, of why bother? Why bother subjecting yourself to a church community like this? Why bother subjecting yourself to people who will from time to time irritate you, get on your nerves, raise your blood pressure, and cause you to have to change the way you are living, even though you are right? Why bother with this mess? So the author and the theologian C.S. Lewis, he actually tackles this question in what I think is a very interesting way in his book, The Four Loves. So C.S. Lewis was part of this literary group known as the Inklings. So there are a lot of literary figures in there. It's a group of about 20 or so people. But in that larger circle, he had two really good friends, one guy named Charles Williams, and another name, a little obscure, you probably haven't heard of him, J.R.R. Tolkien. Yeah, obscure little dude. Who C.S. Lewis affectionately calls Ronald. So they were really good friends, but unfortunately Charles Williams passed away. And so in this book, The Four Loves, C.S. Lewis reflects on the changed dynamics of their relationship after their friend Charles had died. And I want to read you a quote from that, because I think his words are pretty powerful. So just remember, Charles is the guy who passed away, and Ronald is J.R.R. Tolkien. C.S. Lewis writes, "In each of my friends, there is something that only some other friend can fully bring out. By myself, I am not large enough to call the whole man into activity. I want other lights than my own to show all his facets. Now that Charles is dead, I shall never see again Ronald's reaction to a specifically Charles kind of joke. Far from having more of Ronald, far from having him to myself, now that Charles is away, I actually have less of Ronald." So the idea that Lewis is getting at is that just to know one person, just to know one individual, you need a whole community. You need a whole community just to really know one person. And Lewis goes on to argue that if that is true of one human person, how much truer is it of God? How much truer? And the reason we gather into messy, diverse communities like this, with people of diverse cultures and diverse backgrounds and diverse upbringings and diverse values and diverse opinions about the best and most appropriate way to live our faith in our daily lives, is that together we have a fuller, more robust understanding of what God's love is really like. Together we have a fuller picture of what Christ's grace is really all about. Together we have a fuller picture of the Spirit's working in the world and in us. Together we have a fuller picture of God than we could ever get alone in a back room reading the Bible by ourselves, relishing in our moral superiority. And so, friends, whether you are a vegetarian or whether you are a committed carnivore, whether you are a beer drinker or, heaven forbid, a mascara wearer, I pray that you may be open to the fullness of God revealed to us in the messiness of diverse Christian community. Thanks be to God. Amen.